Today we're going to look at underlying research questions, and I'm going to speak for a bit for a start, and then I'm going to open the floor up to all of you again so that you can tell me back how you think the underlying research question of your thesis currently looks. Just like last week, there's no need whatsoever to think that this is in any way permanent or binding. Whatever you say in this class today, firstly, will not be recorded because I will switch the recorder off as soon as I finish speaking. And secondly, it doesn't commit you to anything. It really is just a view of where you think you are in week four of term. Every PhD has at least one underlying research question. There is a bit of a debate within the literature on this sort of thing as to whether it should be one and only one underlying research question or whether a series of underlying research questions are permissible. I think most of the time people will start off with what they think is the most important underlying research question, but they will also show how that opens out into a series of sub-questions, maybe. So just like last week, we were looking at the possibility that there will be one primary contribution followed by a number of secondary contributions. That also seems to be the case most of the time when it comes to underlying research questions. I think you will notice, because it will become more apparent over time, I'm sure, that I talk about questions in the plural rather than question in the singular, that what I'm most used to seeing is a series of questions. They might be given coherence by having a single primary question, which then opens up into a series of secondary questions. But in most instances, I think people will go with a number of different questions. Now, what can I do with my slides today to make it more exciting for you? Probably nothing. So I did go with this one, if I can find Fiona, to show once again that I think
I said cat, but obviously no.
That this is likely to be one of the most boring set of slides that you will ever have seen, and given that academics are in general pretty good at producing boring slides, then that's going some to win a dull contest for PowerPoint slides. Let me just show you a couple of PhD theses from students of mine that were handed in this summer to show you how they presented the idea of their research questions in their table of contents. Because I was going to say to you, everyone now is acculturated into the process of always having an individual section in their thesis introduction entitled Research Questions. And I thought I would go back to a couple of really great PhDs from students of mine that were submitted in September to show you that that's true. And of course then the first one that I came to, it isn't true at all. So this one is a wonderful PhD, but he doesn't ever really show exactly where in this table of contents in the introduction you will find the section on the underlying research questions. He's folded this into thesis argument, and that's more than acceptable, but as an examiner, you might very well, at some future point when you're reading through the empirical chapters maybe, you might want a brief reminder of what the underlying research questions are. And the easiest way of being able to signal that to your examiners, of course, is in your table of contents to have a section in the introduction that's specifically entitled underlying research questions. Anything you can do, this goes back to what I was saying 2 weeks ago, doesn't it? Anything that you can do to make life easier for your examiners, you probably have a pretty good incentive to do that. Because they will be the people, the two people that make a recommendation as to whether or not your whole PhD experience is to be deemed successful. So if you can give them a helping hand to show them how to navigate their way through your thesis by using a table of contents in which you can show where these important individual sections apply, then you maybe should do that. This particular character chose not to. Doesn't seem to have done him any harm whatsoever in the way that his academic career is coming along nicely, but he chose not to. Here's another one of my PhD students' table of contents page from this year. And look, he's been much more explicit here. I think this is actually quite nice as a guide to examiners, the way that he set it up. Can you see that? So he's got five sections in his introduction, and he labels them one after the other, so they all focus on a different aspect of the introduction. The case, why it matters, is his first section. Then the problem, which he tells us is where we're going to find his research puzzles and questions. So it's clearly flagged up right from the very first page. Then the approach, method of analysis, the arguments, contributions to knowledge. There we go, there are those all important contributions again. And then the structure, and he gives a chapter outline. Let me give you a few tips as to what I would have in mind when I'm thinking of underlying research questions. And those tips go by these six here. And I will also post these on the module website at the end of today's session. What I think you need to do with your underlying research questions is to make them fit the narrative of the thesis that you want to transmit to your examiners. So the underlying research questions should be fairly straightforward, if possible written in words of one syllable, reducing any potential scope for misunderstanding, and they should be as clear and as concise as possible. Now, it might strike you right at the end of your PhD programme, when you're doing the final revisions to your submitted thesis, it might strike you that you're in danger of dumbing down your own argument when you talk about your underlying research questions in those terms. Do not have that fear at all. If you can express your underlying research questions as simply as possible, this will be a benefit to your examiners. If they can read your underlying research questions in one way and one way only, then that will be an unequivocal guide that they can then use to read the whole of the rest of the 300 odd pages that lay in front of them. If they think there's equivocation or multiple potential readings of your underlying research questions, probably means that you haven't done the best possible job on them. This really, really, really should be something that gives just one clear-cut and decisive message of what your intention is. So here are my six tips, more specifically. Firstly, I've suggested try to ensure that your underlying research questions are substantially relevant. Now, substantially relevant is the sort of phrase that you see in lots of books that are written on how to write a PhD. And substantially relevant means something that's very important, actually. It means that you have an easy answer to the so what question. The most devastating question you can ever be asked as an academic, and this is why, please, 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 if you're sitting in a conference and the call goes for people to ask questions, please don't ask the so what question, even if what you just think you've listened to was a complete waste of 20 minutes of your life. Don't tell the poor person who's just given that presentation that. Because it really is the most soul-destroying question that you can be asked. You spent 4 years writing your PhD. You really don't want the first thing that your examiner thinks they want to ask you being, well, what was the point of all that then? So if you can show that your underlying research questions focus on something that's substantially relevant, that there's a reason for doing this PhD research, and that you're able to narrate very clearly what that reason is, then obviously that is to your advantage. And the whole idea that you could get to the end of your programme and still not have managed to find a persuasive set of words that tell everyone who's reading it exactly what the purpose of the PhD is, that would be very, very disappointing for you. Not disappointing of you, but disappointing for you. So try to make sure that your underlying research questions remove the very possibility that you might be asked the so what question. My second tip is to try to separate clearly your contributions from your questions. This might not be all that apparent how to do that at this stage, but believe me, it will become much more apparent during the course of your PhD programme. It will be easier and easier for you to spot what is a claim about a contribution to the literature and what is an underlying research question that helps to lend coherence to your research activities. It will become so easy to spot that, I think, that if we were to reconvene in 3 years' time and I was to ask you how you're getting on with that, you would look at me as though I'd gone mad, because it would be such second nature to you by this point that you really wouldn't need to think about it anymore. But at this stage, the advice from me is to make sure that the contributions and the underlying research questions are distinct and separate, because they do serve a rather different purpose. My third tip is to try to imagine how your underlying research questions open out into a series of sub-questions. I really do think it's best practice to avoid just having one underlying research question. And that's because PhDs are big things. You're going to be writing at least 80,000 words. Sorry, for the benefit of the tape, you'll be writing at most 80,000 words, because it's not allowed for you to write any more than that. But you'll be writing around 80,000 words. And those 80,000 words are likely to take you in a number of different directions at the same time. All of those directions, of course, will be consistent with one another. They will logically entail one another. They will be sequentially ordered. But nonetheless, each part of the PhD thesis that you write is likely to have a question of its own, or at least a sub-question of its own. Think about that in terms of your contributions as well. It might be that for every part of your PhD thesis, there will be a separate claim to a contribution, methodological, empirical, theoretical, whatever. And equally for every part of your PhD thesis, there's likely to be a sub-question that underpins specifically that part. Okay, my fourth tip is to try to think of your questions as limiters. I'm not actually sure whether limiter is a word, but even though it might not be, I'm pretty confident that you all know what I mean by that. That one of the dangers of writing a PhD introduction is that you allow it to be so expansive that it makes it appear to your examiners that you're interested in absolutely everything. And it could very well be that you're interested in absolutely everything, but not absolutely everything will fit within the framework of a single PhD thesis. So you have to find a way of restricting the scope of your analysis. You also have to find a way of communicating to your examiners how you're going to restrict the scope of your analysis. And I think your underlying research questions can be very useful in that regard, because they can act as limiters. They can act as a means of communicating to your examiners very clearly where the limits of your thesis are to be found. My fifth tip, obviously got a bit enthusiastic on the keyboard with this one, because it's got more words in. Try to concentrate on matching the precise wording of your underlying research questions to the particular explanatory framework you have chosen to adopt. What I mean by that is just try to make sure that everything within your introduction is talking about the same PhD thesis. That might sound a really daft thing to say, but honestly, this is one of the most difficult things of writing a PhD introduction. Because by the time you come to finalise your introduction, you are likely to have written in draft form probably the best part of 200,000 words. There's a lot of PhD in your head. And trying to work out how much of that PhD that's in your head you need to talk about in relation to your introduction is actually quite a difficult task. Less is usually better in that regard. But also, consistency is the key here. To make sure that the different claims in terms of contributions, in terms of methodology, in terms of underlying research questions, they all match the same image of the single PhD that you're saying to your examiners they will encounter once they get into the meat of the analysis itself. And my sixth tip is to try to avoid asking a question which implies an undoable PhD. this is maybe another way of talking about limiters, but from the other perspective. There can be a sense, I'm sure, that everyone gets afflicted with at some stage, that the more ambitious your question, the better the PhD you're seeking to write. That's not necessarily the case at all, because research questions that get too ambitious simply signal to your examiners that they probably shouldn't expect you to be able to do everything that you've just told them that you're going to do. Because if you are trying to rewrite the whole basis of social science in 80,000 words, it's very, very likely that you will fail to live up to your own expectations in that regard. And the one way that you have, or the one thing that you have at your disposal to avoid falling into that trap, is to not to tell your examiners in the first instance that you're trying to rewrite the whole of social science. So you've got to keep it manageable for your own sake. PhD programmes are time limited. They have limited resources that are made available to you to do your original research. And there are word limits as well. And you have to act within those limits. And one of the things that you therefore need to do is not to promise too much in your underlying research question. Okay, now let me tell you the types of questions that I think might be used here. And I know you've been preparing a couple of minutes to tell me about your underlying research questions. And I wonder whether you can spot the type of questions from my list of generic questions. Did anything happen there? There we are. Now, last week I came with 14 generic types of contribution. This week I've got 15 generic types of question. Next week, whatever we're talking about next week, I will try to come with 16 generic types of something or other. But let's just work through these very, very quickly. Firstly, there are often what type questions. So none of what I'm about to say constitutes a hard and fast rule in any way, but in general, a question beginning with the word what implies description. And I think a question that begins with the word what should primarily be used if you want to emphasise the significance of the empirical content to your overall thesis goals. So if, in your mind, your contribution is primarily of an empirical nature, I think it makes sense to start experimenting with questions that begin with the word what. Because I think questions that begin with the word what match very closely contributions that are of a primarily empirical nature. I can think of two different types of why question, which is why I've got why, which is the reason that I've got why number one and why number two. Why number one? I think a question beginning why often implies explanation rather than description, and it probably is to be used if your focus of your contribution is not necessarily at the empirical level. In this form, it's most usually used when you want to draw particular attention to the distinctiveness of your analytical framework. Of course, a single set of events can be used as the underpinning to any number of different theoretical and explanatory narratives. You can explain the same thing in multiple different ways, depending on the starting position that you use within the theoretical literature. And it could very well be the case that if that's the sort of work that you're doing, then a why type question might be more for you. Also with why type questions, so number three now, a question beginning why can obviously also imply a normative focus. And this might usefully be used if you're trying to understand why one thing happened and not another. It can also be used as a way of trying to understand the type of value judgment that might be imposed upon the thing that did happen. So there are likely to be why-type questions of that nature as well. Next, I've got how questions. I probably should have grouped together how does, how might, and how to, shouldn't I? But obviously my mind wasn't working in such a clearly ordered way when I started to think about this. A question beginning how will tend to focus on a mechanism, one which might be used to explain processes of either political continuity or political change. Most PhDs in our department focus upon processes either of continuity or change. Or sometimes people will say that they're focusing on processes of continuity and change. But continuity and change can be useful ordering devices, and possibly a how type question would be the most useful for trying to capture that. If I move on from how to how does, then a question beginning how does implies a practice that can be studied empirically in a bid to understand the concrete dynamics of that practice. So how does X lead to Y? What are the processes through which a linear conception of causality might be applicable in any given case? How does one thing create the effects that are observed at a subsequent mode of time? Sickly, I've got how successful. Again, this would seem to mean that a value judgment is being enacted here. You might need to create a standard for how you were to judge the success of a policy, an intervention, whatever it is. But a question beginning how successful, I think, does imply a process of authorial evaluation, whereby you as the author invoke a particular type of judgment on a particular event. There is, I think, as a consequence, an important normative element embedded within questions of this nature. If you're asking how successful, I think you're inevitably making normative judgments on the process that you're interested in. My seventh generic type of question is where questions. And a question beginning where will often be used when employing the comparative method, especially if the objective is to ask about the location in which an outcome is particularly apparent. One of the reasons for using comparison as a social science methodology is to move away from making assumptions about the universality of social processes. That it might very well be that the mediating influence of a set of political institutions or a particular embedded culture change what in other instances might look like a universal process into something that has distinctly time and place-bound characteristics. That was all a bit of a mouthful, just to say that one thing might not be the same in one place as it is in another. And where type questions are a way of getting to that. Another comparison, of course, is across time rather than across space, and when type questions might be useful in that regard. Question beginning when might also imply the use of comparison, therefore, but it's a comparison that seeks to explain through temporal sequencing. One thing happens in one period of time, another thing happens in another period of time. There might very well be a narrative of change that helps you to tie together those two events at different periods of time. But the comparison across time itself is likely to give you a when type question. Who type questions are often invoked when the object of interest is to try to explain who it was that was particularly important to a particular policy being enacted. If you can imagine a policy network in which there are competing actors all seeking to influence the eventual policy decision, it's likely that there will be a differential pattern of influence if you were to look at each of those actors individually. So it could very well be, for instance, that you're interested in trying to identify the most important actor within a particular policy network, and within that context, then who type questions are likely to be the most important. My tenth, I'm nearly there now because this is two-thirds of the way through, my tenth generic type of question is a whose question as opposed to a who question. And a whose question is similar to a who question, and it can be usefully asked, for instance, when trying to decide whose influence most obviously comes to the fore in any particular discussion of policy priorities. 11th, I think there are can questions as well. Can questions will tend to be used when it becomes necessary to ask whether something is possible or not. So if you're looking at issues of possibility, whether those possibilities are emergent or whether those possibilities are observable already, then a can type question might very well be quite useful. Number 12, to what extent type questions. Obviously in the social world, very few things fit into an either or framework. Most things go beyond that binary division between being either one thing or another, and there are likely to be gradations of that particular thing in evidence at any particular moment of time. And if there are gradations of that thing in evidence, then you might very well want to ask to what extent questions. Number 13, I've highlighted how might questions. This suggests a trajectory of adaptation which is to some extent still ongoing. And as a consequence, it might be possible to ask about the likely continuation of the existing trend or how might that trend develop in the future. So how might could be used to think about the sustainability of a policy adaptation. How might it be possible to continue on with that trajectory in the future? How might political consent for that change be generated? Number 14, I've got is. I think that's the shortest of the questions that I have there. Is, under a conventional hypothesis testing methodology, it often becomes necessary to ask whether there's a correlation between two variables. And in that case, you would simply ask, is there? Is there a correlation between those two variables where one thing can be said to be related to another in a statistically significant manner? And finally, perhaps the last thing that I need to say for this afternoon is how-to questions. There might also be occasions on which you might want to ask how to measure a particular variable, for instance. Especially if your contribution to the literature is a methodological contribution, which is about re-specifying the content of a particular social science variable. How to find a way of rendering that variable measurable and then applicable. So this might apply in particular to more quantitatively oriented work. But whenever you're thinking about variables that might be measured or might be given some sort of quantitative character, then how-to questions might be applicable. So that's all really, I think, half an hour that's taken me. That's all I think I need to tell you today about these generic question types. And I can see from the look on your faces that you're pleased that I've come to the end of that presentation. Because at one level, this must surely be about just telling you what could very well be said to be blindingly obvious. But at another level, I think it's useful to be presented with the blindingly obvious when you're thinking about how to put a PhD together, because sometimes it's better to talk to your examiners at that level. Certainly when you're setting your PhD up within your overall introduction, the more straightforward and the more simple you can make your communication with your examiners, the better. And it's often a difficult task for people to identify exactly what it is that they're trying to ask. They will know what their general area of interest is. They will know what they're trying to do in broad terms. They will have wonderful ideas of how to talk about that if somebody has 3.5 hours to sit down and listen to them talk about it. But it's much more difficult to try to reduce that to a series of interrelated questions that help to bring some sort of vibrancy to the ideas in your thesis as a whole. So don't worry if you get a little bit stuck when thinking at this stage about your underlying research questions. I think that's entirely natural. But that's what we're going to do for the rest of this session and see how far we get.